So actually the title of the Dharma talk is Dharma talk. It's really about living and speaking the teachings. And all of you have had a significant part of your life in connection with the Dharma. And you have learned and experienced things, and you have coming from a different world, from the norms of the world around us, the maskanot, the usual stream of automatic behaviors and thoughts and responses of the world around, and you're coming with a teaching from a little bit far away from the rest of the society, and Dharma comes from the East and so on. So you have, in a way, a unique voice, and it's a voice that the society really needs. And I do see in the Dharma the potential for renewal, of a very sick society, a very sick world, and that the renewal has to come from somewhere, and it always comes from voices from the outside. It's hard for the thing to renew itself. When I went to America at the beginning of, like, some years ago, and I was standing somewhere, I forget where, in some small town on the way to somewhere, it's in New Mexico. I was teaching in the Zen Center in New Mexico, and I was on my way there, and I realized that there's absolutely no way that American civilization could change, even if the whole planet will burn up totally. Like, it just couldn't. Because the society is based on the motor car, and on, you know, their structure is built and finished. And the change has to come from somewhere else. And it always has done. So I think that your voices are really important. More important perhaps than you realize. And we have a voice that can heal to some extent ignorance, can heal the loss and the woundedness and the damage that's being inflicted on each other and on the environment. It's a voice of sensitivity. It's a voice of ethics. It's a voice of compassion, not avoiding the pain, but listening to the pain. It's a voice that we sometimes find we are ready to take risks where other people are too frightened, are ready to take risks because we are steady and we are concentrated and we see things a bit differently. We have maybe a voice there with a bit more trust, and the world really needs our trust. And so basically we're needed, I think. And in that sense, it doesn't mean to say that now we all have to be missionarium and go out and become sort of Superman Buddhist save the world. Instead of Superman costumes, we have orange robes. But it does mean that we should allow our voice to be heard. And what that means exactly, I want to talk about this evening. What does it mean, allow our voice to be heard? And what does it mean, our authentic voice? And how do we do that without falling into many possible traps? Like the missionary trap is one of them. So, the first thing to realize is that our awareness, our meditation, our observation, our inquiry, even the course we're doing this last few weeks, it creates a place of being heartful, being clear, and being less full of our own stuff. Less full of our own inyanim stories and tavniot. That already is enough to be able to have an effective voice. Because what stops people from listening to us is if we talk from no trust, if we talk from ignorance, if we talk from obsession, or we talk from our psychological mess. And so if that's already lower, reduced, people will tend to listen to us. And we, more than we realize, people will tend to listen to us. We might not notice that they listen, but we might often have an effect on people. Doors can open for us to unexpected doors sometimes, just simply because we have less greed, hate and delusion, less stuff, less obsession, less... And people need to trust, they need to feel safe. And basically they'll feel safe with us. there's a safety, and so our voice can be heard. And it's amazing, in my own life, going back from, like, when I first came back from India in 1976, 77, and I did a doctorate in medical research in London, and just coming from India and going on meditation courses and having that year in India and a different way of looking, and I noticed the way scientists I'm working with, who were very tough-minded people usually and very critical, and they want you to check everything that you say, I really felt that they were listening to me in a way which was different. Now, they tried to put me in a box called, oh, the hippie from India who's a scientist and so on. Yeah, but okay, we know you. All of that is for sure, and they'll do it to you, and they'll do it to each other, and they'll do it, and that all of that is certainly going to be there. Nevertheless, we can cope with that. And people can say that, and they will say that to us. Oh, you're just a Buddhist, you know. They'll say it, but it's still the voices will, our voices will get through. Maybe not this one to that one. Maybe not here to there. So I noticed that when I came back from India, I heard there were many people that were listening to me, and I could start organizations in the England in the 1980s. I set up the major national organizations for alternative medicine, the Research Council for Alternative Complementary Medicine, which is a major organization, the Center for Complementary Medicine. There were major national British organizations that had millions of pounds and so on, and I started them with one or two others just from that sense of my voice needs to be heard. There's no alternative medicine in the UK. I come with another view. I'd love to do something. Get together with a few guys, and we did it. And I feel it was because of that energy of India, of clarity, of meditation, of being rather not full of bullshit and, you know, my own sort of obsessions. It's just like a free bird coming and doing unusual things, and they worked. And I think it's important to have that confidence. Karma will work for you. Doors will open for you because of the reduced greed, hate and delusion. And you need to notice it. It may not be, oh, if karma is working for me, why can't I earn another 10,000 shekels a month. I need. Why can't I get a new car? Karma's meant to be working for me. If Stephen says karma's going to work for me, why is it? Why we can't? We have to be more reflective. But doors will open that will not open otherwise. Another way of looking at this is that as we practice over years, we build paramis. And the paramis, those of you who have been on the course with me and know about them, are qualities of the personality that are actually the engines that drive action in the world. And we have a whole course on them, and they're very important because it's exactly, we may not notice them, but if we sit meditation retreat after meditation retreat and class after class and book after book that we read and the groups that we connect with and so on and so on and so on, something is changed in us, in the personality. And these are the paramis. The personality is less attached. There's renunciation, vitur. The personality is a bit more calm. The personality is a bit more easy and joyful. The personality is a bit more loving, compassionate. The personality is a bit more honest and truthful and inquiring, chakira. The personality is a bit more, is a bit more, has a bit more energy and not depression and passivity, etc. These are paramis. And they are the actions in the world. Because of the paramis, karma opens doors for us in our own life. And we really need that to happen. So, a voice needs to be heard. How do we do this? One of the basic ways we do this, I think, is not to try and be a Buddhist personality. Not to try and be a Buddhist. But to trust that the paramis working through us. And therefore, when we talk to people about life, we really need to bring examples from our own life. We need to bring daily life kind of examples. The daily life framework, that's where we come from. We talk to people about their daily life. We talk to people about our life and their life. We don't come preaching a package called the Buddhist Dharma. We talk about life and daily life and their life. So that sense of being connected with people, that connects us with people. As soon as we start talking from a professional Buddhist place, we lose people. So we need to keep that language, and also we really also will make mistakes, and we may not have the authority for that. We may go start blubbing on about what the suttas say, and you know, we may be way off it because it's such a huge teaching. And you know, better to stay and trust who we are and talk to people about daily life and talk to people about our own life and our own experience as examples. And the other thing is, go towards, if you can, go. And this is delicate, go towards the truth, the first noble truth with people. In other words, a way in to people's hearts and minds is to acknowledge suffering, acknowledge their pain. People are in pain. And that pain, once there's a way of allowing that to happen, to be acknowledged, it's radical. And just as a small example, when we were doing dialogue workshops with Palestinians all through the 1990s, beginning of the 2000, we did these weekend workshops, and we were there 48 hours and sleeping in Palestinian homes in Nablus, and working all day for 2 days. But there was one session always on the second day, which was just an hour, and that was the heart of the whole thing. From that one session, everything changed. From there, peace was made. And that session was simply sharing our suffering and pain. The Palestinians, one Palestinian and one Israeli, sitting face to face for 45 minutes, the Palestinian telling his or her pain, and the Israeli telling his or her pain. And all the weekend was built to make that happen. But it was done with deep listening and respect. That was the weekend was built. Safety, relaxation, being okay together, being able to share that pain was the whole weekend. And then the essence of it was that 45 minutes when peace was made. And so if you always, if you can, allow the truth of dukkha to heal, to be exposed. Once you see pain, it's, and you share it with somebody and you listen to the pain, it's you're in Dharma, you're in the Dharma world. Another issue is people will ask questions. People are curious. They do want to know why you sit for hours in a meditation retreat there. What the hell are you doing there? What's going on? It reminds me of this joke that maybe I told you about two mothers and two daughters. So two mothers meeting each other, and they have two daughters who are a bit lost. And the one mother says to the other mother, "Well, how's your daughter?" "Oh, she doesn't know what she's doing. She's lost. She's just hanging around. She's a bit miserable. How's your daughter?" "Oh, she's same. Oh, dear." So they complain, the two mothers. They meet again 6 months later. "How's your daughter these days?" "Oh, she's just the same." "And how's your daughter these days?" "Well, she's more or less the same, but she did discover something called Vipassana. I don't know what it is, but at least she's not sitting around doing nothing." people are going to be curious. And there is a hunger in the world. Don't forget that people are in pain because of what's happening in society. It's not people have a good heart. Fundamentally, there's even that you see people that seem to be so hard and making such a mess of things and hurting others and so on. But underneath, they are in pain. They do want to heal. They're looking for some way. It's just they don't know how to do it, and they're not sure what to do. And so often there will be a hunger for release from pain, which is expressed in many ways. And people who are crazy, running around like crazy, high-tech or politics or don't know what, there's a little kid in there that's in pain and doesn't know how to do anything else. And so the questions will come to you, and even invitations will come to you to talk and to explain. And so it should be... they're important, and then you become one of the basically divine messengers, like of the Buddha, you know, one of the shlichim, just by answering a question and by being there at the right time in the right place when someone is really curious. That's how I started teaching. I had no intention to teach in the middle of the 90s. Two or three people from Carmiel said, "We hear you've been very involved in Buddhism and Dharma. We read one or two books. Would you like to come and tell us?" That's how it started, the whole thing. Otherwise, no intention to teach, especially. I'm just practicing myself and living my life. But so listen to those voices that are asking you. They're important. And one other general point is you can, it's really helpful to see everybody as a kind of a baby Buddha. That even though they may feel so lost and they may be making such damage and they may be dressed up like the Prime Minister, they may be they may be doing, you know, so disasters and so on, but inside there you can relate to them not as a lost, totally lost case, but there's somewhere inside them there is something that needs to be heard. Yeah, you see a small, tiny little Buddha inside, or should we say, in other languages, don't underestimate the spirituality of people. You know what I mean by underestimate? You understand it? You know, give them credit, because this already can change something and open a dialogue with people. That if you look at them with eyes of respect, because you see in them a little bit of a baby Buddha, this is just wise way of beginning dialogue and for them to listen to you. So, about language, there's a Zen comment that says the whole of the Dharma is just words that fit, a fitting word, a milam matima. The whole Dharma is just a word that fits, hatama. And that's our work, to find the words that fit the situation. That is not easy. There is our work. And for that, we really need deep listening to the other person. We really need to be able to see where the other person is coming from and fit our language to them so that they understand. And Shai was mentioning before what happens when, you know, someone who's just no way, way, way away from anything you want to say, do you just shut up? My view would be, yeah, maybe sometimes you need to shut up, but many, many times you just need to find a language that fits the situation of this person. And that means learning a little bit about what is needed by this person so that you can get the right response. In the more spiritual world, it's like if someone asks a question that is deep, you go right to the depth without being frightened of that. And if someone asks a question that is very minimal, shallow, radud, shidhi, you go there. Don't have to be, because I'm a Dharma person, I must be deep. Or,
Afuch.
Nobody understands the depth. I can only talk in kaze, little baby language. No, you go deep when people allow deep. You be shallow, shidchi, if that's what's needed. It's okay because you don't care. There's a famous dialogue with Achan Cha. Achan Cha being the major figure that really developed or helped develop the modern Theravada Buddhist practice. And one time someone came to him and said, where's Achan Cha? And Achan Cha answered, I can't tell you. Achan Cha is a fiction. He's a pure construction. You can't find him anywhere. And another time, someone came to him and said, how old are you? And who are you? He said, I'm Achan Cha and I'm 70 years old. So the monks then said, well, why did you answer one like that to one person and then to another person from a Thai village? You answer just simply Pashut. He said, because I answer according to what people are able to receive. And if it's entirely on the world, the relative world, Yachasi, Olam Yachasi, then that's where I'll be. But if it's possible to go to the Olam Hamukhlat, the more ultimate place, I'll be there ready for that too. So I think that that's the key for us, to be there at whatever is needed and not have an agenda that we have to say certain things. And it's also for us important to keep a deep awareness of what is language. And as I was saying before, language is an agreement. It isn't more than what it is. It's not the whole thing. It's what is possible to package into words and send out to somebody else so that they understand. That's all it is. So language is a kind of consciousness packaged into bottles. Chaviot, bakbukim. The ocean, haokeanos, betoch bakbukim. Zemilim. Shenachnu zorkim et bakbukim, al haokeanos. Meser betoch bakbuk. And nevertheless, it's it has power, language, and so we really need to keep exploring language. And this is part of the interest in communication. It's actually having a job to do, to develop language, to enjoy language, to write, to talk, to write poems, to really enjoy the language, because it's a skill. It's like able to be, it gives us power to package our consciousness very well into language. And then we learn through language, and language helps us to understand what to do, to understand how our voice is. There was a monk I met in Switzerland, ex-monk, who's Swedish, and he left after 14 years in the Buddhist monastery. He left, and he came to Sweden, and he became sort of very quickly a media personality in Switzerland. And he has radio, hugely popular radio show every week, where he gives talks on the radio and interviews people, and it's really hugely popular. He's so well known, apparently, in Sweden. And he's all over the country. He gets invited by companies and by organizations and to give talks all over the country, all the time. He's a very popular guy. And we were talking about what he does when he goes into a company with 500 ofdim and menahalim and so on. And he says he, first of all, makes sure that his language is positive, his language is humorous, with humor, with ease, and beautiful language as much as possible. He goes with quietness into these talks and expresses from quietness what he wants to say, and usually he talks about ethics, because people really need that voice, and that voice of ethics is usually very problematic, because people come with ethical voice, very moralistic or superior, whatever. And he says, what I talk about is the beauty of being a human being, of an ethical human, an ethical life as being something beautiful. And that's just an example of how, for us, language can be used right in situations like that, like talking to people in the street. So we have a lot of learning to do about this, about the way we use language in the Dharma, for speaking Dharma. There's a lot of middle ways. I mean, we can fall two ways, this too much this way or another way. For example, if we're too much coming with a teaching, we lose people. But if we're too much just me, we also lose people. So it's okay. We've got to find a middle way here. If we say, I am the Dharma, me, you know, I'm a Dharma person and this is me, and I'm, you know, we're falling too much into the self. If we are talking in the name of the Buddha, we're falling too much into taking authority from the Buddha and trying to be bigger than we are. If we are just quoting, we only quote the texts and the sources and what Jack Cornfield said and what this said and what Stephen said and what Christopher said and so on, we make ourselves too small. We're actually reducing ourselves. So here are fine lines that we need to learn. This takes time to learn these things. And we'll fall down. And we'll make some mistakes on the way. And that's okay. And we're always helped by mindfulness for the present moment. More or less every problem is solved by our honest, open connection to the present moment, to be in the now. To be really in the now, in the spontaneous now, kind of solves a lot of dilemmas and the dialogue between me and Safek and I need Sirikliot Yoter, or I need Pachot, or I need, you know, tmicha, or I need lo tmicha, or it kind of dissolves. Or as much as we can be totally in the present with somebody else, we'll be okay. We'll be all right, and we'll make some mistakes, and it'll be okay. And so, in the bottom line is, I think you're all able to be teachers of the Dharma, but with a small t and not a big t, if you know what I mean. In other words, not a Dharma teacher, which, anyway, I don't know what that is. But teaching Dharma is all those things I said right now. And it's just the language using teaching is not a very helpful word, that's all. It's kind of animalamed. It doesn't feel like a good word. And it's not really, but it is, it is what you do as you go out with everything that the paramis that you've accumulated in your life. You go out into the world and you feel the pain of the world and you feel the pain of others and you want to help them with your compassionate heart and you have a certain open, free presence, and that's teaching. And you teach with your eyes, you teach with your words, you teach with your presence, you teach just by being there at the right time, in the right place. You might teach with a technique. So some of you are therapists or psychologists. Fine. Technique is also a language. It's just a language, like any other, anything else. I'm talking about that with MBSR people, the mindfulness-based stress reduction courses that and trainings that are going on in Israel right now and in the world. But there's some people have a problem with its rather structured training in mindfulness. But it's also a language. It's just a language, which is agreement to pass a technique. So I don't see there's a problem. I think the language can be many different things. For one person it can be a technique, for another person it can be something else. It's just language. And I just invite you to find your place where, and explore the places where you feel your heart tells you, I'd like to communicate with others. I'd like to share, I'd like a little bit to heal the world, I'd like to give something, to offer something, and have the trust that you'll be all right, with you'll be okay. Yeah. Thank you.